Ron works at MIT. He's one of the founders of modern cryptography. He's going to be speaking at Turing and the Growth of Cryptography.
Thanks, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation. It's wonderful to help celebrate the 100th birthday of Alan Turing with all of you. It's always hard to speak after Silvio, but I'll give it a try. I think this will resonate very much with what he said and talk about related topics. So this is a sort of a breezy overview of cryptography, so partly seen from my viewpoint. It'll try to emphasize some of the themes that resonate with what the work of Turing did. Part of that's hard because a lot of what Turing did is still classified and we don't know what he did. So I don't actually have a lot to say about specific contributions to cryptography during the war and so on. So let's get started. So a lot of modern cryptography has to do with number theory, so you can allude to the traditional starting points with Fermat, you know, the Fermat's little theorem, which he didn't prove, but except experimentally, I guess. A to the p minus 1 is kind of root to 1 mod p, where p is a prime. Euler later on generalized and proved this. So you know, if the greatest common divisor of a and n are 1, then a to the phi of n is equal to 1 mod n, where phi of n is just the usual Euler phi function. So, you know, mathematics developed and so on too. Gauss picked up these themes and did what a wonderful treatise, Disquisition de Arithmeticae, where he talks about the problem of distinguishing primes from composites. And he says the problem of distinguishing prime numbers from composite numbers and resolving the latter into their prime factors is known to be one of the most important and useful in arithmetic, and it's certainly proved to be one of the foundations of cryptography more recently. The dignity of science itself seems to be require the solution of a problem so elegant and so celebrated. Of course, he's conflating here two problems, the problem of detecting primality and the problem of factorization, which, as we've seen, they don't necessarily go together. Then there's this fellow who's not often mentioned so much, William Stanley Jevons, but I like him for one case. He's one of the first people to propose a computational challenge of this sort. He asked, what two numbers multiplied together will produce 861-646-0799? He didn't offer any money for this or anything, but he said, I think that it's unlikely that anyone myself will ever know. So he predated Turing a little bit in his challenge. And this is like a phone number, right? This is 10 digits, and you could factor it on your phone these days with a suitable algorithm. So, and he died, in fact, without knowing what the factors were, but it was factored by Derek Lehmer in 1903. You can check it yourself, 89681 times 96079. So this is, multiplication is a nice example of a one-way function, as Silvio said. It seems to be, you can multiply two numbers together easily. Unmultiplying and factoring seems to be hard. So, well, this is math and some early implications of, you know, indications of complexity theory and the relationship. The thing that really made cryptography blossom is radio. Right? This happened at the turn of the last century, 1895. Marconi did his experiments. Radio was a game changer for the world of warfare. You could command ships remotely. You could give orders and get information intelligence back from your troops remotely. Of course, it made everything available to the adversary. You could also listen in. And so radio was a tremendous stimulus to the development of cryptography. In fact, it had an impact on the conduct of World War I, too, because the encipherment of the Zimmermann telegram from the Germans to the Mexicans, promising the Mexicans all of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona back if they would only be allies, was deciphered, and that decipherment really was one of the primal causes for the U.S. getting into World War I. So this all happened basically before Turing was very, very young at the time, 1912. So there was that happening then. The one-time pad was patented, I guess, in 1917. Turing would have been only 5 then. But as we've seen so far in these talks, and I regret having missed some of them earlier today, Turing, you know, developed the foundations of computability. The key question was, you know, what is computable? What are the limits of computation? Can we say something about the power of computation? And as you've all seen, he's led the development of this wonderful theory of computability. And the idea that all models of computation were equivalent to the Church-Turing thesis, as you've also seen here. So the model of computation doesn't matter for computability. Given enough memory and sufficient computational primitives, it doesn't matter what you do. So these foundations are precursor to what's needed for cryptography. You need to have explicit models of computation in order to think about what an adversary might be able to do. You need to think about how these models of computation might affect what an adversary could do to your crypto system. The restriction of general computation to polynomial computation, or restricted, you know, time-limited, memory-limited computation, is also essential if you're going to think about cryptography precisely. So these foundations that he laid were essential for the development of cryptography. And he got involved in cryptography, as we all know. Right? So he was involved in the World War II effort, the breaking of Enigma, and Purple, JN-25, the naval Enigma. He was involved at least in the first and the last of these. At that time, the computation was, the encryption was done by these machines, these wonderful machines. You can still find them on the market. I think the going price for one of these machines now is about $200,000 or something like that. But one of my colleagues at MIT said, oh, look, I found one of these things. And I was able to borrow it for a little while, and he showed me. Push the buttons and the lights light up and so on too. They still exist. As you can see, the rotors here turn like an odometer style. The information from the key goes in through the rotors, gets reflected at the end and comes back out. Having the interesting property, therefore, that the encryption of any letter will never be itself. And that's one of the weaknesses, actually, of this particular machine that was, gave the Allies an edge into this decryption of this machine. So the work was incredibly deep, still classified, a lot of it. Turing, others at Bletchley Park. There's a wonderful museum at Bletchley Park I recommend you see if you haven't. William Friedman and others in the U.S. Shortened the war, arguably, by many months. May not have been decisive in the war. The Allies probably would have won anyway. It's a hypothetical question, but the impact of cryptography was huge on the war. And the development of early computers, as we've seen too, is the people who worked on this effort, many of them were key players in the development of computer science, the development of computing in the practical development, so as we saw also from Martin's talk. But we're still learning about what Turing did during this effort. There was a paper just released by the National Archives of Britain called The Applications of Probability to Cryptography by Alan Turing, declassified May of this year. Which actually doesn't have a lot of content into it, which is maybe why it was declassified by modern standards. It doesn't say a lot about the Enigma per se. It's an interesting paper. The British first wanted to charge $200 for a copy of this paper, a PDF copy, and they eventually were argued into saying, you know, $1.50 would be all right. But Turing didn't publish at the time much. I mean, he was not an academic in the cryptography sphere in the sense he was putting things in public journals. He couldn't. I mean, the Official Secrets Act prohibited him from publication a lot. And so he was happy to contribute to the war effort, to do what he could to break the Germans' cipher, to do a lot of interesting math as part of that. But the publication of his cryptanalytic work is still, by and large, classified. He had an impact indirectly through people like Claude Shannon, who he met at Princeton, was my understanding. And Claude wrote one of the first papers on the theory of cryptography, the modern theory, 1945. He published a paper, it was later published in 1949 in the Bell Systems Technical Journal, and it proves that the one-time pad is secure, among other things, and introduces other notions of diffusion and confusion, and so on, too. But one could speculate or argue that, you know, Turing's discussions with Shannon and others at Bell Labs had an impact on the development of this theory. And I don't have any personal information about that. Publication, by and large, of crypto work was suppressed, was not done. One of the interesting examples of that is the Codebreakers. Well, I mean, David Kahn had a monumental tome where he talks about the history of cryptography from the Egyptians all the way through World War II, per se. But he doesn't really mention what happened in World War II because he didn't know. In the 1960s, that was still classified. If you look at the index of the Codebreakers, and I double-checked it, my copy this morning, there is no mention of Turing whatsoever in this book for his contributions to the breaking of the Enigma in World War II. So Kahn, this encyclopedic tome about the development of cryptography, he didn't know about Turing whatsoever at that time. The second edition does talk about it, but the original thing. And then to say, even so, tried to attempted to suppress the publication of key parts of this book. Kahn went ahead and did so anyway. So in the 70s, things started changing. The work that was done in World War II started coming out. There's the Ultra Secret and lots of other books that talked about this. And also there was a switch from military cryptography to commercial cryptography. So the data encryption standard was developed by Horst Feistel at IBM. We used to live down here at Cape Cod. Had an interesting ladder structure to it. And NSA got involved in helping out on the commercial side a bit there in return for keeping the key size small. So you know, things started changing from being entirely secret, entirely military, just realizing that we need good cryptography in the commercial sector. At the same time, in the 60s, computational complexity took root, and Urs Hartmanis, Dick Stearns, laid some of the foundations. Michael Rabin was involved in some of these. Manny Blom, Steve Cook, Dick Karp developed the theory of NP completeness. Cryptography is all about NP problems often. You guess the key, secret key, you can verify it. So the theory of NP completeness, again, helped lay the foundations for this. Polynomial time reductions, NP completeness are key to the field here. So the tools with which we could start talking about the limits of practical computation, what could be done in polynomial time, were being laid in the 60s and early 70s. Public key cryptography, marvelous insight by Ralph Merkle and independently by Marty Hellman and Whit Diffie. The idea that you could encrypt something and give the adversary the means to encrypt, and thereby not give him the means to decrypt, was a brilliant insight that they had. Published New Directions in Cryptography, again, a publication trying to lay some of the foundations of theory. We're at the brink of a revolution in cryptography. They really were right there. They helped lay those foundations, lead us forward. And they proposed the idea that you've all seen before, that in public key cryptography, everyone's got a public key, which anybody can use to decrypt messages to you, and a secret key, which allows you to decrypt. And it's easy to compute pairs of these, but hard to find the public key from the secret key. So that was the key idea that they proposed there. And so there, and they also talked about some of the systems aspect. You know, every public key can be listed in a public directory that gets the owner's name. Great idea. Digital signatures were, again, a new idea, which didn't exist, as far as I can tell, before this paper. It's actually one of the things that got me interested in cryptography. There's not so much argument you can make for military need for digital signatures, but there is an argument that the commercial side really needs digital signatures, and we see that, again, today in the commercial sector. So you can produce a signature for a message given the secret key. You can sort of symmetric, you can effectively, in their model, encrypt the message with the secret key and can check it with the public key by re-encrypting that ciphertext with the public key that was posted. So you use the public key for verifying signatures. All this is well known. These are amazing ideas, though, I think, and Turing would have appreciated seeing these. But the digital signatures and so on, these ideas we're not implemented. So here's a picture of three random guys with glasses and everything. I don't know. Actually, you folks will appreciate this. This is a picture that was taken for some. Well, we had a little joke here on the board. I don't know if you noticed this. There's a therefore P equals NP written on the board here, which the photographer, of course, didn't appreciate at all. It was a picture taken at the time. So, you know, the RSA scheme is well known by now and still hasn't been broken, although people have tried to beat up on it pretty well. So you've got a public key consisting of a product of two primes and an exponent and so on, that you raise the message to the eth power to encrypt, and you raise it to the corresponding dth power to decrypt, where d and e are multiplicative inverses mod phi of n. So this was speculation on our part that this might be a useful scheme. We talked to Martin Gardner, who we thought might know something about factoring, because he liked puzzles, and factoring at the time was sort of his arcane thing. And he actually got interested in this and wrote up this. And then we offered a copy of the technical memo there. So this is a change from the old model that Turing worked under to, you know, publication of ideas and an open discussion of ideas, right? So this is the kind of thing that Turing couldn't have thought about doing at all. Publishing an idea, asking people what they thought about, you know, what do you know about factoring, you know, and having an open discourse about this. And so the world has changed there, and I think he would have would appreciate the change in openness. We offered $100 for the first person to break this product of 129 digits and our estimated time to solution. So this is our version of Jevons's challenge, right? We offered $100 too. We estimated it would take 40 quadrillion years to break this particular puzzle. I don't really recall how we came up with that estimate now. It's based on some arithmetic error in part. But the formulas for computing the difficulty factor were also not well known at the time. We published a memo. Now here we hit a problem with not classification, but with the publication issue, right? So the world was changing back in the 70s from this classified model to an open model. And we saw letters. Marty Hellman got a letter saying, you can't publish this kind of stuff. You can be in violation of the International Traffic in Arms Regulations. And so it took us a while to discover that we could actually publish this memo and distribute it out. And the paper itself we finally published in 78 after the lawyer said, yeah, this is okay. There's an exemption in ITAR for academic research, which still exists. Alice and Bob first appeared in that RSA paper. Turing had some scenes in some of his papers where he personified some of the things he's talking about. Can you tell if it's a man or a woman behind the screen, right, and stuff like that, too. So the expository talents of Turing have been talked about, too. So Alice and Bob, so we did that first in the RSA paper. You can find them on Wikipedia. Alice and Bob are everywhere in cryptography. So if you're a student, you're interested in crypto papers, just look up Alice and Bob and you'll find them. Now, the Brits also continued their work behind closed doors, too, and it came to be known in 1999 that in the tradition of Turing and working secretly behind doors, that they had, in fact, before Diffie and Hellman, before Adi and Len and I made our discoveries, they had also made these similar discoveries, and eventually, so in the 90s, they decided this was something they could talk about. But they didn't do anything with them. Right? It was military, and things like digital signatures seemed not to be so useful. In fact, it's not clear they had the idea of digital signatures. Right? They had the idea of public key encryption, maybe, and public key exchange, but the idea of a digital signature, to my knowledge, is not something that they had independently invented. So Diffie and Hellman deserve credit for being the first to invent the idea of a digital signature in the model that they had. For those of you that are students, students make contributions to cryptography. Lauren Kohnfelder was an undergraduate at MIT, invented the idea of a digital certificate in his master's thesis in 1978, supervised by Len Edelman. So the idea that you can certify that somebody else's public key should be bound to a particular name first appeared there. It's an extraction of the public key directory idea that Diffie Hellman had to a particular line of that directory and digitally signed by the issuer. Very important idea now, and you all have certificates in your browsers. Crypto theory. You probably recognize these two, Silvio and Chaffee, started developing the modern theory of encryption with their paper Probabilistic Encryption, in which they argue, among other things, that encryption should be randomized, and that's a key insight, and they justify that with some theory, which I think you can argue derives from Turing, as I'll explain further. And Silvio and Chaffee and I also worked on the security notions for digital signatures, too. This is just an example. There's lots of theories develop about these times for these notions, but these are, I think, are key contributions. The notion of a game to define a security objective as part of the view that's pervaded crypto theory ever since. So following on Silvio's talk, I want to emphasize a point that he made and maybe put words in his mouth a little bit. Turing asked, can machines think? And he proposed this indistinguishability test as an answer. I'm not sure whether it should be indistinguishability or undistinguishability. I think they're both okay in English. But, if you can't tell a machine from a human by conversing with it, then the machine can think. That's sort of the definition. And if you've got something hard to define, definitions are very important. And this notion of indistinguishability, you take, in some sense, what you think is the ideal for what you're trying to achieve, and you take what you've got, and you ask, can they be distinguished? And if they can't be effectively distinguished in practice, then you've achieved that definition. So randomness is really the same thing. You say, can I distinguish this pseudo-random string from an ideal random string? Indistinguishability is at the heart of the notions that Silvio talked there. And he didn't say so explicitly, but he very, very well may have been inspired by this, either consciously or unconsciously. Turing's definition of indistinguishability, I think, is very much inspiration, I think, for people thinking about how to define hard things. Can you make an indistinguishability test? And so this model of indistinguishability has become the paradigm for many other notions of security. Computational indistinguishability is the phrase that's often used here. So ciphertext indistinguishability in the early paper that I mentioned, can you distinguish the encryption of a zero from encryption of a one? And the pseudorandom number generators can, as Sylvia talked about, at great length already. So I think we can argue that at least the idea that Turing proposed for the definition of intelligence, this notion of an indistinguishability test, really has had, at least potentially, and Sylvia can elaborate on to what extent he was actually thinking along these lines at the time he did this work, on the definition of the right definitions for pseudorandomness and security. The world keeps changing. Just like radio revolutionized the need for cryptography back in the early 1900s, the World Wide Web in the 1990s has changed things again. We now see crypto pervasively in browsers and throughout. Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, really played the role of Marconi, I think, in this transformation. And it also cemented this transition of cryptography from primarily military to primarily commercial. Cryptographic policies have evolved in the 70s. As I said, we had issues with trying to publish academic research. MIT played a strong role, and I appreciate that as a faculty member there, the role they played at supporting researchers in cryptography to see that we could publish, and trying to see that U.S. policy was pushed in the right direction. And there were study groups and very influential advocates for this in the administration at MIT. Nonetheless, the government kept pushing back. At times, at parts, we said, no, let's try to put a secret key that we know in everybody's chip, you know, maybe a little bit like Sylvia's 300 bits, maybe that's it. But the Clipper chip was there, and that eventually got laughed out of town as being infeasible and not a good idea. Today, U.S. policy leans towards strong cybersecurity, strong cryptography for all as a matter of national security. There's almost a panic that says we need much better security, we need cryptography applied well and applied everywhere to protect our power grids and equipment. Attacks, well, that number I mentioned, it got factored. Very much like the attack on the Enigma, a lot of work by a lot of people together to break a particular challenge. These words were revealed, and we paid up. You know, so there's the folks that did this. All right, Munster was the lead. This is part of that number that got factored. So we learn over time. That's one of the things you learn about cryptography, is that sometimes progress is forward, sometimes it's backwards, right? It's the only field in which you think you've made a contribution. And then because we don't know how to prove lower bounds yet, you know, we don't know how to estimate accurately yet the difficulty of computation for particular cryptographically useful computations. We think we know something about them, but it's still on. We don't know if P is equal to NP yet. Factoring seems to be, there is progress in factoring. There's the 129-digit number. The current record is a 768-bit number. But you know, the current numbers in use are 2,048 bits. There's a looks like a fair size gap there, but you know, it could disappear like that if somebody comes up with a polynomial time factoring algorithm. And Turing loved different models of computation. You could ask, what difference does it make if we go to quantum computation? Quantum was mentioned earlier. So Peter Shor at MIT has developed a well-known fast factorization algorithm, which runs on these still hypothetical quantum computers to factor them. So if you can actually build these machines, RSA is a crypto system is dead, and other systems that depend on the difficulty of factorization. That's no longer a one-way function, the process of multiplying two things together. But so far, there hasn't been a lot of practical progress yet. There was a result in 2001 where IBM researchers have factored the number 15 and confirmed that it is indeed 3 times 5. Actually, this year, there was an improvement on that. The number 21 has been factored, and it is 3 times 7. But, you know, these things sometimes start off slow and go ahead. You know, we don't know where it's going to go. this could be a dark cloud on the horizon eventually for RSA, things like this. We're still learning about the universe, as Sylvia says. Cryptography has blossomed. There's lots and lots of wonderful things that are being done. Secret sharing, anonymity, commitments, multi-party protocols, elliptic curves, hardware, key leakage studies, that's very hot these days, encryption by proxies, crypto on your smart cards, password-based encryption, random oracle theory, oblivious transfer, zero-knowledge proofs, which Sylvia knows about, payment systems, voting systems, homomorphic encryption, lattice-based cryptography, private information retrieval. There's just hundreds of conferences and many, many interesting topics that the field is bifurcated into. Public infrastructure, concurrent protocols, the difficulty of proving things are secure when you run them concurrently, randomness extractors, tweakable encryption, differential cryptanalysis, identity-based encryption. I could go on and on. I'll stop. Here, let me just mention a little bit about one of them, which has become a hot topic and quite interesting. So fully homomorphic encryption, back in 1978, Len Edelman and Mike Dertouzos and I asked, can you compute on encrypted data while keeping it encrypted? Can somebody take a bunch of ciphertext and do meaningful, interesting operations on it? And Craig Gentry, a few years ago, was able to show that, yes, you could, based on lattice encryption, based on lattices. And again, this is something that Turing might have appreciated. We're taking one model of computation, working with these operations on the lattices, and trying to show that you can implement another model of computation, the familiar circuit-based computation that we know how to do finite commutations with. And so he was able to show that that actually works and can be done, and that those ideas are being refined and improved. They're still marginally practicable for some situations, and in the next decade we may see really substantial implication, improvements on that kind of stuff. So there's a brief sketch of some of the things that have happened in crypto and in some of the ways in which Turing related to that. Crypto is not a solution to all of our cybersecurity problems. There's a lot of work that needs to be done on the system side of this, but crypto is an essential component. Crypto is fascinating. For those of you that are students, I encourage you to explore it further, take courses, try to find some good research questions, and push the field forward. We've done a lot. There's still a lot more to be done. It'd be great if you can prove some lower bounds, too, of course. Like Alice and Bob, crypto is here to stay. And I think Turing's influence extends much beyond the breaking of the enigma, which he certainly was involved with, to influence on the proper formulation of the adequate definitions of security through these notions of indistinguishability and so on, too, that I mentioned. So I'll stop there and wish my birthday wishes to Alan Turing. Thank you.
One doesn't really need public key, but the advanced encryption standard, for example, is sufficient. One example would be storing information in the cloud, and then you have your private key, you use AES with yes. some key size, and that's how you store the information there, etc., etc. Can you make a statement about what, to your mind, what is the general perception of the security of, say, AES? So it could be that numbers could be factored yeah. efficiently. AES is, of course, much more opaque and does not depend on a simple mathematical problem. So what is now the current thinking about how safe we are with AES using a sufficiently long key?
Yeah, so like all of these problems, there's this wonderful cartoon at the beginning of Gary and Johnson's book, you get confidence in the difficulty of a problem because all these other people have banged their heads against it. So factoring we believe to be hard because people have tried to beat up on it. AES, similarly, people have looked at it and it seems to be standing up well. Unlike hash functions, where there's been this bit of panic about the development of hash functions, the MD5 function that I worked on, totally broken open by Xiaoyan Wang, SHA-0 and the related things have made people nervous because of their similarity to MD5. And just this past month, And NIST has announced the winner of the SHA-3 competition as their backup or their new hash function to replace the others over time, with a feeling that maybe the structure will be better there. But I think AES, which is the question you asked specifically, seems to be okay, right? I mean, there have been people who have been poking a little bit here and there, but there's been nothing major. There's no algebraic structure that's been found to be sufficient. My own personal belief is that'll be fine for a long time. And that there's no, so there's, you can use it with confidence. Yeah. You don't have probably the greater, at least subjective risk that you do with something like factoring, where, there's a mathematical structure that might be somehow, AES doesn't seem to have that kind of thing, intentionally, of course. And you can get by with that in a private key system